Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a top cop's explosive claims rocked the police ministry, Ramaphosa, to address the nation on Sunday. What South Africa stands to lose in a global tariff war. Citrus on the brink, US sanctions could wipe out rural jobs, and how humanities are being rewritten for the future. It's Friday, the 11th of July. And let's start with this. South Africa's security sector is facing a crisis of confidence as we head into the weekend. KwaZulu-Natal Police Commissioner Lieutenant General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi has publicly accused the police minister, Senzo Mqunu, of obstructing probes into political assassinations, colluding with syndicates and sabotaging a task team that investigated hundreds of politically motivated killings. The fallout predictably has sparked nationwide debate on policing, corruption and the president's next move. He is due to address the nation Sunday on this issue. Let's try and make some sense of this. I'm in conversation now with Willem Els from the Institute for Security Studies. Willem, first of all, a real crisis of legitimacy here. These allegations are absolutely extraordinary. What do they reveal, do you think, about the current credibility of the SAPS and its leadership?
Yes, it is extraordinary. And as the president also noticed in his statement, that is of national importance and also security. So what it poses to the police, of course, the trust levels of the public in the police is at an all-time low at 27% at the moment. And this incident might even further deteriorate that trust of the public in the police and in the management of crime in South Africa.
Trust is one issue, but what about the real impact on policing? In practical terms, Willem, could this, what is essentially an internal revolt, have any impact on day-to-day crime fighting, particularly in violent and politically sensitive hotspots?
Of course, it poses a leadership challenge within the police as your police officers. And let me just state, you've got many, many police officers that are straight and they really are there to combat crime and they're doing the right thing. Now, for those guys to perform their duties in an effective way, they need good leadership and they need to trust their leaders in order to do their job. Unfortunately, we do have the bad apples, and it seems that the bad apples are just becoming more and more within the police, and that also deteriorating the trust between the various police officers. Who is corrupt and who is not corrupt? That is your challenge.
What do you think Mkhwanazi's very public attack says about Senzo Mqunu's leadership and political position within government right now?
Well, when he started off just over a year ago as the Minister of Police, he made all the right noises. He came up with good strategy on the different fields, his engagement with public-private sector and state entities in order to form partnerships with the police. All of that, it was positive moves that came from him. And we were full of hope that maybe that will start to turn around what is currently the challenges within the South African Police Service. But given these allegations, and also we must just understand that these are still allegations, it's not been tested in court, but given these allegations, it really poses severe questions towards his credibility and towards the interference of the police, because it seems that the line, the divide between your political leadership and your operational leadership of the police has been blurred here.
And a real day of reckoning on Sunday. The president is slated to address this issue at 7 o'clock at the weekend on Sunday. I'm just wondering how much authority he realistically has to act decisively and what you think he needs to say.
Well, in the first place, it is going to depend on what he's being allowed to say. Remember, he is, in the first place, he's the president of the country, but he's also the leader of the ANC, and we know that they govern through consensus. And it's also going to depend what they're going to decide before and then how they're going to deal with this. They do not have a very good track record in dealing with these type of challenges. As we've seen in the past, every time there's a commission of inquiry, it costs us millions of rands, and at the end of the day, the recommendations are not being regarded. So he cannot follow that route this time around. I think this is too serious, and also your saturation levels on grassroots level with corruption and also the looting of the state and the poor governance has reached really levels that are unprecedented. So that might pose a severe challenge for the president and might prompt him to be more decisive in his outcome and also in his leadership. What we need is here, you know, you can't, who's going to govern the governors? You cannot have a political debate, even though we have to have it, and make the decisive recommendations there, because many of the people that are part of that debate might have been implicated in the revelations by the general. So we need an independent judge, maybe a retired judge, that will have to have a very short time period in order to investigate, and then those findings must be acted on.
Are you concerned about regional instability within KwaZulu-Natal as a result of this? In other words, could it embolden violent local actors?
Of course, you know, it's a volatile province. We saw what happened in 2021 when one of their leaders were implicated and acted on. And so we see here, if you look at both Nkunu and of course, Magwanazi are from Natal. But what we picked up on social media, especially in the rhetoric that is running around, is that not only in KwaZulu-Natal, but more specific in KwaZulu-Natal, is that Mkhwanazi is extremely popular with the people on the ground and also with the police officers within KwaZulu-Natal. He's a strong leader, he's a decisive leader, and he's walking in front. So should they act on him as the whistleblower and as the person that stood out now as trying to counter corruption, it might have detrimental responses from the people on the ground.
And what role should Parliament, the public protector, or for that matter, the entire judicial process play right now? And we've got to ask the question whether there's real political will for independent scrutiny here.
Yeah, that is the main question, I think. But the problem with the judiciary and Parliament, as I mentioned, you know, they are all being implicated in this revealings by or revelations by General Mkhwanazi. So even though the judiciary now want to came out with a report or response that is good, but at the end of the day, you know, if you are being implicated, you cannot really do an impartial inquiry. That is why we suggest that a retired judge actually take control, that is one that is being trusted and one that has also proven that he is not being tainted.
And that's where we're going to leave it. Willem Els from the Institute for Security Studies, thank you very much indeed.
Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA. Mind-blowing, innovative and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other, a unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win 2 tickets worth nearly 4,000 rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy 6 unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff. Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as trade tensions between global superpowers intensify, Africa suddenly finds itself both exposed, but also, I think, uniquely positioned. Tariffs rising, export routes are shifting, and geopolitical alliances are being redrawn. With AGOA set to expire, the question is no longer if Africa will be impacted, but I think how it's going to respond. And joining me now is Gulam Balim, who's chief economist at Standard Bank, who has sat on a panel at the bank's Africa Unlocked 2025 conference in Cape Town on that issue. Gulam, a very warm welcome. So no doubt the continent at a strategic crossroads, but in real terms, what do you think it means for ordinary businesses and economies across the continent?
Jeremy, at the headline level, of course, these type of developments are unwelcome because it injects one uncertainty and real walls in terms of the tariff frictions, and that can, of course, temper both business confidence as well as the inclination to invest. But that said, there are several areas of silver lining. Firstly, the disturbances from the United States does not appear to be tripping global growth as many initially anticipated. So the subtraction to global growth from, let's say, January 2025 expectations is not that severe for a few reasons. One is that global financial conditions have in fact eased rather than hardened. So put differently, interest rates in most markets are lower and access to capital is not materially impeded. The second reason is commodity prices have held up reasonably well. And in fact, we think commodity prices will rise over the next 2 years by about 20%. And commodities are very important, not just for South Africa, but for a variety of African economies. And that through that channel, again, the damage to the global economy or to African economies has not been as severe as anticipated. In other words, we seem to have avoided the tail risk of a global recession or severe bludgeoning. The additional feature that gives cause for cheer is that in many African economies and in South Africa, inflation is either falling or fairly benign. And what that has meant is central banks can come to the party, so to speak, and lower interest rates, providing domestic tailwind or idiosyncratic nudge to growth prospects. So in that respect, we think that at least cyclically, the outlook is not as bad or as worrisome as it could be. And if I could just add another dimension linked to your question more meaningfully, seven of the world's fastest growing corridors exclude the United States. And by that, what we're trying to suggest is that even prior to Donald Trump, trade activity was burgeoning outside of the United States, and Africa was included in that trade dynamic.
So in that respect then, and particularly as the African Growth and Opportunity Act is set to expire, you talk about that silver lining. Gulam, how do African economies and notably South Africa's economy capitalize on that quickly? What do they need to do in order to pivot quickly and seize the opportunity?
Jeremy, so I mean, this may sound a little bit academic, but the first thing is to realize that we're in a fraught geopolitical environment. It's not temporary. It's not what we say cyclical. It's here for some time. So geoeconomic and geopolitical contention is the subject matter of the next few years, if not more than a decade, firstly. Secondly, I think you used the word pivot. Many of our clients are telling us that, in fact, they are receiving orders from, say, the Far East or the Middle East for goods that otherwise would have been imported to those nations from the United States. So, seemingly bizarrely, South African exporters are replacing American exporters in this time of cross-Atlantic frictions. And this is occurring in the farming industry and also in certain and select manufacturing areas. One significant car manufacturer has signaled, for example, that they're getting inquiries from Europe for motor vehicle export from South Africa, given existing platforms, given the frictions between Europe and the United States. Now, I guess that just speaks to this, let's call it friendshoring opportunity amidst all of those frictions. Now, having said that, it's not. I don't want to be generalized about it because, for example, we're seeing headlines where Mercedes-Benz South Africa is also more vulnerable because 90% of its exports of vehicles actually go to the United States. So it's a bit of a varied picture, but the idea of what we're calling an arc of opportunity that stretches from the Western Cape, Cape Town, through the Middle East and to the Far East, where more aligned nations with more common international values will be able to establish multi-year channels of trading opportunity. It's going to be slow. It'll take time, but the die has been cast.
Well, let's talk about that arc of opportunity. And you talk about the cross-Atlantic tensions, geopolitical realignment well underway. So where does BRICS fit into all of this? Does it offer a viable counterweight to the traditional Western trade partners that we've seen? Or do you think we may be overestimating the immediate potential?
So BRICS, and as you well aware, BRICS Plus, as it has more recently evolved into, combined with notions of the Global South, speaks precisely to this idea that geopolitical dimensions and globalization is refashioning itself, and even prior to Donald Trump's emergence for his second term. So put differently, the die had already been cast. And this realization that the Global South is emerging and must forge greater integrations. I don't think that despite President Trump's assertions and attempt to temper China's rise or to even derail increasing associations amongst BRICS nations or the Global South, I don't think his endeavors will work. Of course, he will attempt to stymie it. He will attempt to undermine the G20, for that matter, and he will attempt to force frictions between emerging market nations. And I suspect that he's not going to, that will not succeed. And quite simply, if we look at the pattern of trade and financial flow changes over the last 30 years, increasing arc of opportunity integration is going to take place. And I will just conclude by saying, the catch-up economies are in the emerging markets. Faster-growing economies are in the emerging markets. And leaning into those markets will be for greater prosperity for Africa. And this is quickly, I should say, not to undermine America's importance or to suggest we should be actively delinking. We should engage with the U.S. and attempt to establish some sort of new equilibrium, but not forsake the Asian or Middle Eastern opportunity.
And Ghulam, let me just use that word pivot again and just ask you a quick question about a lot of chatter around lowering the inflation target. And I'm interested to get your view very quickly on the technical and economic explanations of doing this. It builds on Saab's modeling, I think, of showing the midpoint is now more attractive. But where do you see positivity and where do you see downside here?
So the vanilla case is quite simply the belief that low inflation is good for the economy. It lowers uncertainty and it increases efficiency. So, that's the central bank's sort of raison d'etat. It's a reason for existing, firstly. Inflation is fairly low right now, at around 3%, and the Reserve Bank, as any bank would want to do, will perpetually want to drive steady state inflation lower to, say, 2 or 3%. Now, the Reserve Bank wants to use this window of opportunity now to reset the inflation target focus from 3 to 6% to perhaps a point target of 3%, and I endorse their ambition. The difficulty or the trade-off is that when you attempt to lower the inflation targets, the markets assume you will then have to undertake a more conservative interest rate posture. In other words, higher interest rates that would otherwise be the case with a higher inflation if you're pursuing a low inflation target. So the suggestion then, if you're going to lower the inflation target, it may come with some growth sacrifice. If the Reserve Bank is allowed to move quickly, in other words, given mandate by the National Treasury, with inflation now at 3%, it's quite possible that inflation expectations could then drift lower more quicker than if inflation was, say, at 4 or 4.5%. So there's a window of opportunity that could, in fact, limit the growth cost to the economy if that inflation target is lowered soon. And the further delay, the more the growth cost would be.
I'm going to thank you for that. Ghulam Balim, thank you indeed. Chief Economist at Standard Bank. He's been sitting on a panel at the bank's Africa Unlocked 2025 conference ongoing in Cape Town.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Washington's latest move to hike tariffs on South African farm exports could deliver a blow to one of the country's most productive export sectors. While much of the political noise is focused on identity politics, the real story is economic. The tariffs threaten the viability of key value chains in citrus, table grapes and nuts, and that supports tens of thousands of rural jobs and bring in billions in trade revenue. So if implemented, the US decision could force exporters to pivot away possibly from their most lucrative market, and there are obvious consequences for farming communities and agribusiness. I want to talk now to Dr. Boitsoko Ntshabele, who's the chief executive of the Citrus Growers Association of South Africa. Dr. Ntshabele, a very warm welcome to you. And if these tariffs go ahead, have you wrapped some numbers around it? How many farms or jobs in the citrus sector, in your opinion, are at immediate risk?
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for having us on your show. Yes, we have. So we export citrus out of the Western Cape and the Northern Cape, and the challenge is that mainly it is vulnerable rural towns, like towns of Citrusdal, that employ these people. And in that province, we are looking at 35,000 jobs that are at risk if this come into be.
Do you believe, does the association believe, that the government right now is doing enough behind the scenes to engage more assertively with US trade officials? Or do you think that farmers at this point have been left to fend for themselves?
Look, we've been engaging with government since this came into being in April of this year, and we have no doubt convinced that government is committed to ensuring that we find a solution to this problem. We believe that perhaps what has been announced now is more of a call to say, can we finish this before the 1st of August? And the reason being that the initial announcement had been wanting this to be implemented immediately, but you would recall that there was a 90-day reprieve which ended on the 9th. Mm. And had the decision been made by the Trump administration to implement, that would have been implemented on the evening of the 9th. And therefore, we see this as saying, can we get this over the line? And it's really a call for negotiations between the US and the South African governments.
And are you getting any positive signs in that respect at this point?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. We spoke to government immediately when this was announced, and the impression we're getting is that a lot of work is being put into place to ensure that these meetings take place, and that we hopefully from government side, they chaperone this to finality.
But you can't sit back, though. I'm assuming there are alternative strategies that are already being discussed. We know that the United States is this country's second largest citrus market. But it would be difficult, surely, for the industry to pivot quickly to alternative export destinations. That takes time, doesn't it?
It does. It does. But the one thing that is not generally known is that we are an industry that's built on exports. So we already export to over 100 markets. We are the second largest exporter of citrus in the world today. We do know that the challenge is always that when we produce citrus on the ground by growers, it is for specific markets. And that is what makes it difficult to pivot, because you find that there are specific market specifications in terms of product quality, specifications in terms of health, but also specification in terms of maximum residue limits that are acceptable in those markets. But yes, we are continuing and looking for new destinations for our product.
And where are those destinations?
Look, we're looking at markets in India. We're looking to further growth into China. We're looking for further growth into Japan and South Korea. But we're working hard also to get into the Southeast Asia markets, Philippines, Thailand, and so forth. So we've been at it, and we are hoping that with the support of government, we were happy to hear the president announce that more diversification is required. Hopefully, they are going to throw resources at it in terms of people from Delco to do trade diplomacy, people from the DTIC who should be the ones on the ground already looking as to what are the challenges in those markets. We know that we are hit by high tariffs in some of those markets currently.
Even if you find new markets, though, it's going to be difficult to make up the US shortfall or deficit, isn't it?
Yes. And looking at it, we don't want to walk away from that market. And let me explain. We are positioned to grow to about 260 million cartons by 2032. This year, we are looking at 171. So that's big growth. And we want to grow in every market that we are playing. So we don't want to walk away from this market without putting up a big fight for it.
It's not just, of course, direct jobs that are under threat. I would imagine the broader agribusiness value chain in the sector is exposed. I'm thinking of pack houses and logistics companies.
Absolutely. So the entire value chain has to be almost looked at in terms of the potential impact and how much of that can be redirected into other areas. So you're absolutely right. And some of it, you know, you find that some farmers themselves are involved in the further down the value chain. And that might have impact in terms of farm income and so forth and profitability.
And while all of this is happening, and this is a last question to you, it's difficult, I imagine, for the sector to remain future focused. I'm assuming that a tariff escalation could potentially break the business case for reinvestment and expansion in the short to medium term.
Yes and no. So we've got our own what we call Vision 260, premised on growth, and our growth is exports. We want to pivot. We are going to reassess as our season ends in October, and probably pave a new way forward, depending on how this ends with government and the US.
Thank you very much indeed. It is an issue that we will be keeping a very close eye on. That's Dr. Boitsoko Ntshabele, who's the Chief Executive of the Citrus Growers Association of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, a major new academic partnership between South Africa and the United Kingdom is set to put Africa at the forefront of global digital futures research. This is important. Wits University has announced the appointment of Professor Eugenio Gagliardone as the inaugural SA-UK bilateral chair in digital humanities. It's a field that explores, as I understand it, how history, culture and technology are intersecting to shape the future. And the new chair is going to drive research that uses artificial intelligence, archives, and indigenous knowledge to reimagine how African societies build, govern, and innovate, not as followers of global tech trends, but as originators of new ideas and systems. So, Professor, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's start off very basically here. What do we mean by digital humanities, and why is this important in the current context?
Well, digital humanities has meant many things at different times. So I think it started as a discipline like 20 years ago. And at the forefront, the digital was seen as the innovative, the cool part, and the humanities were seen as something that needs to be rescued in a way, that were not as relevant for the economic development or for, you know, placing countries at the forefront of different forms of competition. In the past decade, at least, things have changed. And especially in the Global South, there is a greater awareness of the importance of the humanities in creating different and more inclusive forms of digital innovation. I'm not that old, but I'm old enough to have seen, and you've probably seen it, Jeremy, as well, the first ideas when the internet became a global phenomenon. Africa, there was a sense that the digital could be used to fix African problems or to help Africa. And we are in a different phase. We're at a different conjuncture where different parts of knowledge that have been put on the margin historically are regaining center stage. And so the idea is to pay a lot of attention at African arts, African literature, African architecture, and in connection with the digital, making it more visible, not just for a group of experts, but for population at large and globally.
Professor, it's encouraging to hear that you say Africa is no longer playing catch-up as far as the digital paradigm is concerned. But is there real evidence that African societies are really and truly shaping innovation and not just consuming it?
Well, it depends on where we look. You know, if we look at data centers, of course, data centers are big tech. You know, there is Kasawa Technology at the same time that is a big player on the continent. But again, the lion's share is the US and China. So we don't have to fool ourselves and say, well, we have this fantastic infrastructure and we have plenty of skills. So in a way, South Africa, but also Europe, if you consider Europe, as by some scholar, is called a digital colony. There is not European Facebook, there is not European Google, there is not European big players in that regard. So Africa and Europe are much more similar than one would expect in that regard. We can play catch up, and we will always be behind. But if we look sideways, and I've seen, I always use this example, my colleague at WITS in architecture have done fantastic work unearthing forms of indigenous knowledge in architecture and using artificial intelligence to reimagine the city landscape of Johannesburg. There is this video, you can look it online, everybody can Google it, it's called Noga Mojozi, and you would see the roundness and the beautiful connection within the earth and both big structure and also very simple structure for informal settlement connected with indigenous knowledge, how much more beautiful they are of the square architecture that I love Johannesburg's skyline, but those are truly inspiring. So if we look sideways, we can play completely different games. If we want to play the same game that China and the US are playing, of course, we are not going to be at the forefront. But that's where what it means to connecting the arts with the digital. So really paying due attention to the creativity that is there and connecting with the digital, it can take it to scale.
Can you bridge the divide for me now? In practical terms, how would an indigenous knowledge system or even pre-colonial archive inform something in the present day, like urban planning or even tech design?
Right. That's really hard work. This is what, you know, one of the big challenges of this chair, you know, I'm not alone in this endeavor, and is creating practical example, because I do understand the puzzle. So how do we actually do it? And right now, I just have some example. You know, hopefully, if we speak in a year from now, I can have something that we produced ourselves. And for example, there are colleagues at the University of Stellenbosch. The project is called LEAP, and it has rebuilt an economic history of pre-colonial Africa through the travelogue. So when you know, the Portuguese or the British were just traveling and not, you know, before colonialism and trading with the coast of Africa. And all these travelogues give an opportunity to reconstruct a specific ways in which connections work, societies work, trade work. And the whole idea of the nation state, for example, I always refer to my colleague Achille Mbembe in his words like, pre-colonial Africa didn't have this idea of hard borders, but had this idea of flows and how these flows connected is where values were produced. So with tools like artificial intelligence and tapping in this archive, we can do something that's called a counterfactual. How would history be if certain things hadn't happened, or certain ways of connecting had been more important and could exist today? And I'm not saying that this is something that you and I or anyone can experience today, but creating these forms of imagination can give us, again, ways to think sideways. Our world is a scary one right now. We need new paradigms. And it's different from a theorist, an economist that comes out there and say, look, this is my theory of the world. Mm. This is something that has happened, has been structuring societies at a specific point in time. And how can we retap into that form? And produce it as a scenario that in some ways at some point can also influence policy. Let's do it indifferently. Let's not think it like just South African sovereignty, but let's connect with the network of states and create a pool of data that we can all tap into and do things a bit differently. And I know it sounds abstract for now, but we are working on the examples, and I hope these will be there relatively soon.
And Professor, maybe just a final one on risk as far as this is concerned, and just hear my argument here that artificial intelligence is central to your work, but we also know that AI globally is under fire for either concentration of power or just for bias. How is your research going to approach what would seem to me to be a contradiction?
Well, it is a contradiction, and I think it's with very careful and diligent work that is aware of context, is aware of the complexities. So it's not the chair by itself that is gonna solve or these big challenges. But for example, at WITS, recently, just a few months ago, we launched an artificial intelligence center. It's called MIND, the MIND Institute. And it's interesting how interdisciplinary this center is. It allows people like myself to connect with psychologists, to connect with computer scientists. And a very interesting debate that we have started is about the use of chatbot for addressing mental health issue. The risk there is enormous because these chatbots can look friendly, can act as psychologists, but can also be completely devoid of context. So we are aware of the very severe mental health issues that affect South Africa as many other countries. So in a way, these chatbots could be a tremendous opportunities for people who don't have the means to go and sit with a psychologist every week. But at the same time, the risk is also there when the context doesn't exist. So it's one of my colleagues used this beautiful example. It's like a lot of South African psychologists are probably among the only one in the world that are able to distinguish between some person's behavior as being either psychotic or this person having a call to become a Sangoma. If someone from the US would see this, would never get it. And if we are able, with very careful and diligent work, not like the sloppy use of chatbots that unfortunately is prevalent, to create a very contextual, very deeply, rooted in deep research tools, you can see the tremendous potential there, also for countries that are not playing at the very forefront of the innovation, but then can produce tools that can benefit the population at large. Again, the other paradox is that the chatbots are there. They can do the essays for my students, and that's a lazy way to do it. But if we really sit for a long time with archives, with experts, and we are able to tap into technology and make it available at scale, that could be really transformative.
I'm going to leave it there, Professor. Thank you very much indeed. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.